Hello and welcome to the ICAW Insights podcast with more news and analysis from the world of accountancy, business and finance. I'm Philippa Lamb, and this time we're going to be hearing from the ICAW Technical and Ethics Support Team on the year's most challenging topics for finance professionals. Of course, it is an uneasy time for business. Events at home and abroad are creating a turbulent trading background, and next year doesn't look much brighter. Accountants, of course, are here to make sense of the noise and bring some much-needed stability. But who helps accountants when the answers aren't clear-cut? Well, we're joined by two members of the support team who do just that, David Stevens and Kerris Freemantle. World events move quickly this year, not least after the invasion of Ukraine. The scramble to cut economic and financial ties with Russia is reshaping the global economic map and creating new responsibilities for financial professionals. And ICAW members have reported other challenges too, with activity spiking in some areas of financial services and questions jumping up about ethical obligations around conflicts of interest. David and Kerris, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Philippa.
No, thanks for having us.
We're 8 months on now from the invasion of Ukraine, and the situation and, of course, the implications for accountants and finance professionals, it's continuing to evolve. Can you just give us an overview of the new rules and the sanctions that have been introduced so far?
I'm going to go back to the beginning when this all started around February, March time. Now, the UK already had quite a well-developed sanctions regime in place, but the speed at which individuals and entities were then added to the sanctions, the various sanctions lists, was incredibly challenging. And so we were already getting queries before new primary legislation was announced that would change things even more. And then in May, we had Liz Truss's announcement that the UK was going to implement a ban on accounting services and business consulting services. Now, that was back in May, and we were already getting questions then, you know, literally within hours, within days of that happening. And, of course, then it was very much, well, what's this ban going to look like? Because a policy announcement is not the same as legislation. We had to wait until July then to get the legislation that formulated this ban, which was effectively that persons mustn't directly or indirectly provide accounting or business consulting services to a person connected with Russia. And for individuals, that meant ordinary resident or located in. And for companies, that meant incorporated or domiciled in. And there was some questions then around, well, what was meant by accounting services and what's meant by directly and indirectly. Meanwhile, there are still more entities and more individuals being added to the sanctions list itself. And then literally just a few days ago, 30th of September, the government has announced that a further ban, which is going to include audit services. So the pace of change has just been incredibly dramatic. And against the backdrop of this, you've had organisations, insurers, professional organisations like ICAW, putting out their own guidance to be read alongside and in the context of the legislation as well. So incredibly challenging.
I mean, as you say, extremely complex. Mm. And it all happened at great speed. Obviously, yeah. Companies and individuals, they've had to divest from and cease dealings with Russia. That's been easier for some than others. What have been some of the key difficulties that you've been hearing from members?
De-risking is always a big challenge commercially, and firms having to use their judgment in the absence, perhaps, of clear rules and clear guidance to just say, well, look, it's easier for us to just avoid certain engagements, avoid certain areas. So that's a challenge in itself. And of course, where firms of a certain size are deciding to walk away from certain engagements, that work then filters down to firms that might not necessarily have come across or be used to dealing with particular clients regularly. So the challenge is, in addition to concerns over the fast-moving legislative landscape and regulatory requirements, includes kind of due diligence on new client approaches. Now, ICAW have an excellent screening service that can be used for that. But ultimately, firms that might not have had as well a developed understanding of the sanctions regime before had to get on top of this, had to get on top of all the guidance that was coming out of government and all the guidance that was coming out of ICAW. Now, we don't generally crystal ball gaze when we're giving advice. except for when we do. And I think in this context, we had to advise members not just on the legislation, not just on the ethical considerations around reputation, but also on the direction of travel.
Part of the thing that's jumped out to me is how quickly people have been having to make these decisions, whether it's a decision to step away from a client, whether it's a decision to take them on. Our members are making these decisions very quickly and with a limited amount of information. They're weighing up reputational risk, their professional indemnity insurance cover, and all of this is on top of everything that's happened in the last couple of years already. So we've got very tired members having to make big decisions very quickly. And a lot of conversations I've had, I've been talking about Carba, who are there to offer support to members if they are struggling with the stress that, you know, it just seems to go on and on from one horrible situation to the next.
So, David, I mean, it's highly complex. I think, you know, we've understood that from what you've been saying. But can you give us a sense of what your thought process is when this sort of query comes in?
It's a thought process that we have developed as a team through various discussions as has come in. And I think our starting point is whether the member is dealing with a sanctioned individual or a sanctioned entity, or whether the entity they are dealing with is owned or controlled by a sanctioned individual or entity, because that changes everything. And, you know, OFSI, the Office of Financial Sanctions, they have various guidance on this. There might be situations where a member has to report a sanctions breach or consider to going to OFSI for a license. And as we've said, a lot of members just simply have not necessarily been geared up to deal with this sort of thing before. So assuming the member's not dealing with a sanctioned individual entity, they need to consider whether the work they're doing is covered by the ban on accounting services. And we know that tax has been and remains carved out of that. Everything's changed. Audit was previously excluded from the ban, but we understand that it's now government's intention that that be banned as well. When that will become legislation, we don't know. And considering whether the work is covered by the ban or not only requires an understanding of the CPC code that dictates what comes within accounting services and what doesn't, and there's guidance on the ICAW website, but also that point around directly and indirect services, which we still don't have further guidance on. Moving beyond that, the insurance point, PII, whether or not legislation allows you to do the work is irrelevant if your PII provider won't insure you, because members can't operate without ICAW compliant PII. So that could, a member can go through a long period of getting advice as to whether they can or can't do something just to find that their insurer won't insure them anyway. And across against the backdrop of all of this, you know, members still have to consider their reputational considerations. Is the client they're dealing with high profile? Are they likely to get any media inquiries? With all of this, you know, the vast majority of occasions we're saying, look, to be absolutely certain, seek some legal advice and keep your eye on the ICAW Ukraine hub.
I think one of the things that we can hopefully do here as well is share some links alongside the podcast to some of the key guidance that Dave's referring to there, because there's a sort of a set of guidance that we always work through when we're on the phones with members. And as he says, we always end with this reputational risk. I think the other thing that we can't kind of emphasize enough is speaking to professional indemnity insurers, because if you are making a fine judgment call as to whether this is a piece of work you can do or can't do, should do or shouldn't do, you want to make sure that you're covered by your professional indemnity insurers. And there has been some nervousness in the market.
In terms of insurers being reluctant to actually provide services?
Reluctance in professional indemnity insurers to cover work where there's a Russian individual or Russian company involved.
Or the possibility, presumably, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The possibility there. It's all a lot higher risk. So it's one of the key things we've been saying is, you know, if you do choose to take this work on, it's worth having that quick call to your insurer just to make sure that the work you're doing will be covered. Hopefully, you know, we're never going to need our professional indemnity insurance, but if we do, we want to make sure that it's there for us.
I know the phones at the help desk have also been ringing with queries about mergers and acquisitions. Obviously, that whole sector, it went really quiet during the pandemic, but have you seen activity picking up there?
It's interesting. On the lines, our views are always a little bit delayed because we tend to be talking to the accountants, and a lot of the people that phone us are in practice rather than in industry. So a lot of the time they're dealing with something that happened sort of several months in advance, and often the first time they hear about it is when the statutory accounts are being prepared. So it may have happened a few months ago, then the stat accounts are needed, and that's when they phone us to ask for help. So I think we can be a little bit delayed in seeing it, but we're certainly seeing that uptick now. There's a lot been going on. And I think sometimes you see or you get the feel that the commercial decision has been made and now we're tidying up the statutory appearance later. And a lot of accountants aren't consulted about that. So they're going back and unpicking transactions that are already done and dusted. And sometimes having to talk to clients about presentation in the statutory accounts, which may not be what the client was expecting, because they were making a commercial decision, so they haven't necessarily gone there in terms of what it's going to look like.
There's a definitely a sense of accountants sometimes being dropped in it a little bit, because it's sort of the 11th hour and the client comes along going, we've done this wonderful reorganisation during the year and now can you tell us how we're actually supposed to account for it? But yeah, I mean, it definitely seems to have picked up again. I mean, during the pandemic and during lockdowns, a lot of our questions were on all the sort of life support stuff, you know, the bounce back loans and the COVID support schemes that were coming out of government, the CJRS grants and so forth. So we've almost moved from one period of triage to another period of triage. And it's just the different it's different events that have kind of prompted that.
I mean, are there particular difficulties members are bringing forward about M&A work?
I think it's just the sheer quantity of potential outcomes and kind of unpicking what the transaction really looked like. You hear a lot of terms like there was a transfer, and that's one of those terms that covers a multitude of sins. So the first thing that we're having to do is say, when you say transfer, was it a gift? Was it a sale? If it was a sale, what was the consideration? Have we got a loan? And so a lot of our kind of initial piece with the members is often trying to kind of get through to the nuts and bolts of what the transaction really looked like. And then from that flows out all of the different ways that we could be seeing it presented.
Perhaps, Keris, you could tell us about a real-time example that you've dealt with.
I suppose the one that jumps to my mind is an example where you have, say, a new holding company being introduced over the top of a group. Now, that's a group reconstruction. So you immediately jump to merger accounting, which is a way of doing the consolidation there. Then when you look at FRS 102 and the law around that, we need to have no change in control or ownership in broad terms. And I had an example where we had a small change in ownership. So doesn't tick quite all the boxes for being able to use merger accounting. But when you look at some of the discussion and the guidance in some of the guidance books around this area, it's generally accepted that a small change, an insignificant change, would still permit you to use merger accounting because to all intents and purposes, you're ticking the boxes that you need to be able to do that. But then that leads you to the question of when is insignificant insignificant? So is a 1% change in ownership insignificant? Is a 5%? What about 15? And that's where you see different opinions in different guidance books. And we can lay out all of the different arguments to the members. And sometimes it comes down to the exact situation and that judgment around why was this done in the first place? Because the why often informs the what. Ultimately, you end up with this judgment call where we're sat there with the standard and we're sat there with the guidance books and saying, you know, do you want to look at A or do you want to look at B? What fits your circumstances better?
And how did that one play out?
I think they had auditors involved as well. So they were forming their own opinion and an argument which they were going to go back to the auditors with. And sometimes we are just that. We're kind of the sort of devil's advocate ready for a conversation somewhere else. It's the ones that we love and hate because you get to have a really interesting conversation with the member, but ultimately often it isn't a binary answer. So we can't give them a black and white yes or no. We can share our opinion, but if there isn't a definite yes or no, we can only share our opinion.
It sounded like a lot of the conversations you have with members are long, a lot of exploratory conversation to have before you get to the point of advising at all. Is that right?
It definitely depends on the topic. You get the odd call that, you know, it's a quick yes or no, as long as you know where to look for it.
a point of law or practice.
Exactly. When you have things like we've been talking about today, they can be kind of half hour, 45 minute phone calls. And it can be more than one phone call. It can be the first conversation raises more questions than it answers. And then member can come back with some more information and we can get to the final outcome.
They can get a bit four dimensional. It's a bit like a flowchart that branches off because you've got, you know, various options as to how you prepare the acquirer's accounts. And then that has a knock on the consolidation process, which also has its own various options. So I think, as Karis was saying, we tend to have point A, the beginning, and point B, the end. And it's unpicking everything that's gone on in the middle that's challenging for members. And that's where we can help. And as Karis said, multiple phone calls sometimes. We'll deal with a call. We'll think, right, that's done and dusted. And then they'll come back in and the member will be saying, oh, you've never guessed what they've done now. Or like, I've got this that's just happened as well on top of everything we spoke about. Does that change anything? Sometimes the answer is yes, definitely.
As David was saying, you get the kind of, I thought it was X, but now I've been back to the client, actually Y happened. How does that change things? You know, it can be as simple as we thought they'd paid for it, but actually there's a loan involved, or we thought they paid cash, but actually it was a share for share exchange. And anything like that, you're back to the start and looking at how it all flows through.
You tend to come into M&A queries with a bit of a time lag. The UK economic forecast, it's not great right now. It's looking grey for next year. Are you expecting to see those M&A queries continuing, or do you think it's popped up and it's now likely to damp down again?
I think we could see it going on for a while because we've got people looking at how to survive what's going on at the moment. So we're going to see some people planning some exit strategies from their business or from their group. We're going to see people having to divest, and that always leaves people an opportunity to invest. So I think it's going to go on. One of the topics I'm expecting to start talking about a bit more is probably negative goodwill, because even the FRS 102 itself says if you think you've got goodwill, maybe go back and check you've done everything right and you really do, because it's not expected, but it can come out of a genuine bargain purchase. And if we're going to have people in under duress having to make a quick sale of a business, we could see some cheap deals going through, which then puts us in negative goodwill. Now it's not a common thing, and we often say, you know, everybody else's strange things is our everyday. So that's something I imagine we'll probably be visiting more frequently in the future. And obviously it's not a nice place to have to go to if it is because people are selling because they're in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, that takes us to insolvency, doesn't it? Presumably you have an expectation you're going to be seeing a bit more of that.
We get a number of queries from insolvency practitioners, normally on the ethics side. But the volume of queries around insolvency ethics is generally reflective of the volume of activity on insolvency and on a technical level or on a legal level. And I was going to say that for every sort of divestment, there's usually an investment. But that's not always the case, of course, because due to the challenging economic circumstances, I've certainly had some calls lately where usually smaller companies just seem to be mothballed, if that makes sense, or just abandoned. And sort of a member has called in and said, well, I'm supposed to be the registered office address for this company, but I can't get hold of anyone. Everyone just seems to have walked away from it, and I'm not really sure what I need to do.
And what do you say at that point? What advice can you give?
I mean, ultimately, it's not our members' place to change a company's registered address. And certainly if they're not getting anything from the company directors, it can be difficult. Ultimately, I think the best they can do is, you know, get in touch with Companies House. And if it's clear that the client has disengaged from them, but simply hasn't provided a new registered office address, then I don't think there's any issue with the member going to Companies House and saying, I am not the registered office anymore. I can't necessarily tell you who is, but it's not me. Because, you know, obviously members don't want to remain on Companies House registered office list for a company that isn't their client anymore.
The responsibility of accountants to act ethically and in the public interest, it runs through everything we've been talking about. Right now, I imagine accountants may need to bring that professionalism to particularly difficult and emotionally charged situations.
With some of the queries we've had lately, I'm reminded of, you know, that phrase, never work with children or animals or family, apparently, because, you know, you get many queries around ethics and particular conflicts of interest where the member comes in. The first thing is they write, I've got a company with two directors, husband and wife, and it's sort of facepalm moment because I know what's coming next. And without wanting to almost do kind of like a forced segue from what we were just talking about, I think this is another impact of COVID in many cases, that I think that lockdown and so forth has perhaps put a strain on relationships. And so then the members in a situation where they have got two directors, husband on one side, wife on the other, we've got separation or divorce, usually not amicable. And we're advising them on how best to navigate that situation.
I think it's just that, you know, it's hard enough being locked in your house with somebody when you've got completely separate jobs. If you're locked in a house with somebody at all times and your business is inextricably linked with the two of you as well, I can only imagine how hard that's been. I think I have talked to more people recently where it's members dealing with that sort of situation. And I think the nature of our members generally is they want to help their clients. That's a lot of the reason they do what they do. And so sometimes it's pointing out where they can't help and where they need to protect themselves. And if you've got a dispute, you've got a conflict, you often can't help both parties, however much you'd like to. There's some of the difficult conversations where you've got members that have been in business for a long time, clients they've had for a long time, and actually they're having to draw a line and say, you know, we need to step back from certain aspects here.
Absolutely, because it's a particularly fraught environment, this, isn't it? Navigating interpersonal conflict. And there must be that potential for pressure to act unethically.
You can kind of wander across the line with nothing but good intentions.
Off the back of a long-term business relationship.
Exactly, yeah, off the back of a long-term business relationship, because you're used to dealing with the couple and the business when times were good. And sometimes it's very difficult to hit the reset switch and kind of go, look, you know, and this is one of the first things that we recommend, one of the first safeguards that we recommend is you need to sit down or send correspondence to both these parties saying, look, I'm aware of what's going on, and this creates a very difficult situation. So this is the basis on which I'm comfortable doing business with you now that we know this is happening. Are you comfortable with that? Because ultimately the member then is drawing a line in the sand and saying, this is how I want to do this going forward. And if you're not happy, then we can't continue. And if you're not happy with how I want to deal with things going forward, then unfortunately I'm going to have to walk away. And that might be the right answer. I did have one not that long ago. And it was sort of classic facepalm moment. I've got two directors, husband and wife. They're splitting. They're at loggerheads. The lawyers are involved. One of them's telling me to give them all the information and not give the other person anything at all. And I'm getting the same thing from the other partner. So only talk to me, don't give anything. But of course, directors are legally required to be able to access information about their company. So a member can't really legitimately restrict any director's access to information about the company. And this one member in particular was really struggling. They were getting bombarded daily with emails, angry emails from each of the separating partners and their lawyers. And then one little nugget of information came out of the scenario, and it was that the husband had resigned as a director and was now only a shareholder. And all of a sudden, everything became much, much clearer, because, of course, shareholders are not directly entitled to any information about the company. They have to go via the directors. What was quite a difficult conflict was then made much easier for the member, because they were simply dealing with a single director and a single company. That means that their conflict was almost like removed from them, and they could just go on dealing with the wife and bat away the rather aggressive requests for information coming from the husband's lawyers, because he simply wasn't entitled anymore because he was no longer a director.
So your advice to members is very much about making sure they protect themselves professionally in these situations, first and foremost.
Sometimes you find it's a conversation around, you have, you know, husband and wife, for instance, or brother and sister that have fallen out. You do personal tax for both clients. You could carry on doing both of those things. Everyone's happy for you to go forward, but you can't unknow what you know. So if you learn something by working with one of these individuals, which would impact on the advice that you'd give to the other individual, there's a limit to how much you can put a silo in your own head and not be influenced by that information. And that's where it can be easy to to unwittingly wander into a situation where now you know that information, what can you do with it? And that's where, as you say, we're sort of looking at protecting the members and saying, you know, sadly, even an amicable breakdown of a company or breakdown of a marriage can become less pleasant in the future. And so actually sometimes it sounds awful, but we're almost doing the worst case scenario of kind of, well, it could end up like this. Where would you stand? How are you protecting yourself if that is the outcome?
Yeah, because these conflict situations, the advice presumably is much more nuanced. It's not a binary, this is the right answer, is it? It's a much more subtle conversation about possible scenarios and the way that things may play out. So the sort of guidance that you can offer there, that must be particularly tricky.
Yeah, part of this is about explaining to the member that this might be the situation now, and there might be steps, safeguards that you can put in place now that makes everything okay now. But where is it going to end up? Are lawyers involved yet? And that always adds an extra level of intensity once you start getting angry letters from solicitors. But yeah, you're absolutely right. You're firmly in the grey area where the advice, the safeguards, depends entirely on the facts and circumstances and who's involved. And it might not necessarily be just a family conflict. There might be business partners in the background that have their own interests, and now they're trying to sort of get involved and sort of pushing their agendas on the clients that you're dealing with who are already in conflict. It's entirely, I would say, bespoke advice based on the situation. Fortunately, many of our members don't encounter these conflicts all the time. They might get them once in a blue moon, but for us, it's almost daily.
I think that's where some of our assistance comes in as well, though, because we are removed from the situation. We are free from the obvious stresses and sometimes upset in the situation. So we are that kind of fresh pair of eyes. We're a sounding board. And sometimes you have conversations with members where they know all the answers. They know exactly what they ought to be doing or could be doing. But having that sounding board, having that conversation, laying everything out in one place, it can really help to give that clarity. And we can help to kind of build that roadmap of, right, what are you going to do going forwards? And sometimes you just need that external perspective.
Before we wrap this up, can you just both remind the listeners how they can get in touch with the help desk and indeed access all the other resources that you produce?
One of the easiest ways to reach us is the phone. So the number is 01908 248 250. We're also on web chat. There's always somebody covering the web chat function, and that comes up to you on a lot of our help sheets. It gives you the option. Or you can visit icaw.com/webchat, and that will automatically get you through to us that way as well.
David Kerris, thanks so much for telling us about all the advice on navigating those thorny topics. It sounds like a particularly challenging time to be an accountant. It's great to know there is always support on offer. Thank you.
No, thank you for having us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. You can catch the next Insights podcast in early November, the next In Focus podcast, where we'll be focusing on cybercrime and accountancy. That will air later this month. Join us for those two. And meantime, please do rate, review and share this episode. And remember to subscribe to ICAW Insights wherever you get your podcasts.